Good evening and welcome to Local Motion, where we go in-depth with local public affairs from around the KVNF listening area. I'm Patricia Naft. Today on the show, we'll be showcasing the original feature reporting done across the region. To start, we'll hear from KVNF's Laura Pomasano. In June, she attended a sheep shearing event at the sheepdog trials in Hotchkiss and brought us this report.
For almost a decade, Doug Hamilton has been putting on sheep shearing demonstrations.
I thought it was kind of silly the first time they asked me, because when I grew up, everybody had something to do with sheep. But I soon realized that not a lot of people seen that anymore.
And Doug, what do you do?
I guess I'd say I'm a professional sheep shearer, but it's been my profession most of my life since I was 16. So now I'm 66, so I guess I've been shearing sheep for 50 years.
What brought you to it?
Well, necessity. We had a small band of sheep. We couldn't get anybody to shear them, so my dad and I, we set in to do it. And I got to liking the sheep shearing, and especially the money. I did that most of my adult life. And then, probably the time shortly after my wife and I were married, I bought a sheep shearing crew from her plant, we call it then, from my dad. And we traveled from here to Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, all over shearing sheep about 6 months out of the year. And we farmed and spent our sheep shearing money in the meantime.
Hamilton, who lives in Cedar Edge, says business is slower than it used to be.
Now all I do is shear the small farm flocks, and there's not very many left. I probably shear 90% of the small bunches in four county area. But you need to excuse me right now. I'm going to have to finish those last three sheep.
Ralph Catherine of Montrose says he was impressed by the demonstration.
I thought the man was an expert. No blood on the sheep. And the fleece came off in a pretty much one piece, except the dirty wool that he told us was thrown away anyway.
Makes you walk funny.
Hamilton says he's uncertain about the future of small-scale shearing operations like his.
We're seeing a change in the industry. We're seeing more sheep probably in the Midwest, in the East, and you're seeing fewer and fewer sheep in the mountain states. And especially Arizona and New Mexico, they don't hardly have any sheep anymore. They used to have thousands. The sheep industry probably is going to go to more your hair sheep that don't need to be shorn, and more people going to goats.
For KVNF, I'm Laura Pomasano.
June also saw town festivals in full swing across the Western Slope. KVNF's Jake Ryan brings us this report from Crawford.
Last weekend was Pioneer Days in Crawford. It was a four-day celebration in the center of the small town that included a full itinerary. One of the big events was the outhouse race.
Karen's kids did a lot better this year. Last year, they lost a wheel.
Teams build wooden outhouses, complete with toilet paper and that crescent moon carved out. They attach wheels to them. Someone sits on the throne, and the rest of the team pushes the outhouse, racing down the main drag in town. First place was $200.
And first place this year, and I think maybe it might be the first time, is Sharon's Kids with a time of 7.97. Great job, guys!
Of course, what town celebration would be complete without food stands, specifically burgers? The Crawford Volunteer Fire Department runs a hot dog and burger stand every year to raise money for the event's firework display. Eric McCarter is the Crawford Fire Chief.
Do you guys do any other events throughout the year?
No, this is our only event. It's just so time-consuming for the volunteers in doing this. The amount of hours they put into this, it's a lot for them to do on top of the regular training and everything. So like a lot of the departments, we usually do one big event a year, and it's about all the guys really have time to do.
Another running tradition at Pioneer Days are melodramas. This year's theme was the Old West, so the melodrama troupe put on a Western, full of boos, hisses, and cheers.
Harry, you all right?
Yeah. I mean,
Ooh, yes.
Rick Steckel, has been performing melodramas for 34 years.
Melodrama. It's, of course, instead of just being dramatic, it's melodramatic. Everything is completely overacted. It's like a soap opera from the 1800s. In fact, that's actually where the soap operas got their beginning, is in the melodrama.
And why do you do melodrama?
Because it's a hideous amount of fun. It really is. I mean, it's a lot of work because we have to practice and get everybody together, and everybody's busy, especially this time of year, it seems. And it's a part of being a part of the community now for so long that it's really a tradition at this point. Like I say, despite the amount of work, it is a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun to do it.
Rick says that one of the biggest things that set melodramas apart is that the audience isn't passively watching. They're another presence, another actor. It's the involvement of the community that makes it special. For KVNF, I'm Jake Ryan.
The Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers released a joint proposal earlier this year that outlines changes to the Clean Water Act. Two EPA officials discussed the revisions at a presentation in Hotchkiss. KVNF's Laura Pomisano attended the meeting and brought us this report.
The North Fork of the Gunnison River flows through southwestern Colorado. It's a waterway that feeds into the Gunnison River, a tributary for the Colorado River, which supplies drinking water to millions of people in the West. The North Fork is protected by the Clean Water Act under the definition of waters of the U.S. The EPA and Army Corps plan to change this definition. Under the current language, navigable waters like the Gunnison River, territorial seas, interstate waters, impoundments of water like reservoirs, tributaries, and wetlands adjacent to waters of the U.S. are protected under the Clean Water Act. More than 100 organizations and the Supreme Court have asked the EPA and Army Corps to revise the definition because it's confusing. Two EPA officials from Denver recently visited the western slope of Colorado to talk about the proposed changes. Nearly 30 people attended the meeting hosted by the Western Slope Conservation Center, a water advocacy group. EPA stream biologist Julia McCarthy gave a presentation on the revisions.
So I wanted to start really broadly because I recognize that there's varying levels of understanding about what the Clean Water Act is, what's exempt from the Clean Water Act, and how the Clean Water Act is currently implemented.
McCarthy says the changes will modify three parts of the Waters of the U.S. section of the Act.
Right now, there is no definition of tributary in the existing regulation, and so the proposed rule adds a definition of tributary, which defines a tributary as a water that has a bed and bank and ordinary high water mark that contributes flow to downstream traditionally navigable waters, interstate waters, or territorial seas. But it's the first time that that will be defined explicitly in the regulations.
The revisions also say adjacent or neighboring waters would be subject to regulation, and adjacent waters would include all waters, not just wetlands. Wording about interstate waters that affect commerce will also be removed, and a new term will be added, other waters, defined as waters that are isolated from other bodies of water, like prairie potholes that occur on the Great Plains. These other waters would be regulated if they affect another protected water source.
And then also what's changing is this piece where we've added certain water features and these two types of ditches as explicitly exempt from the definition of waters of the U.S.
McCarthy says under the revisions, it's also made clear that groundwater, gullies, and artificial ponds created on dry land are not regulated by the Clean Water Act.
You mentioned an exemption is return flows from irrigated agriculture. Is that
Paul Kaymeyer farms alfalfa in the area and says he attended the meeting to learn how the changes could affect his livelihood.
I think that it was good to hear clarifications, and my impression is that the EPA is trying to help define things more clearly so that both the farmers and the Army Corps can function more efficiently in the permitting process in our various farming activities.
Ranchers, conservationists, water managers, and property owners were also at the presentation. Carrie Dennison, who works for Trout Unlimited, a conservation group, says he's for the changes.
I hope and I think that it's going to provide guidance for the regulatory bodies, including the Army Corps of Engineers, on how they handle case-by-case situations and how they designate waters of the United States so that it removes some confusion between the Army Corps and water users.
At the session, EPA officials stress that the Clean Water Act is about quality and not quantity. They say the act and the proposed changes don't affect how states allocate water. McCarthy says the agency wants to hear what people think about the proposal, and that's why they are putting on informational meetings.
A riparian area or a floodplain out here in the Grand Mesa area is going to be very different than a floodplain on the lower Mississippi River. So, you know, we want to make sure that the definitions that are being provided in this rule are applicable and make sense for the types of resources that we have here in the West.
People have until October 20th to comment on the proposal.
KVNF has partnerships with other stations across the state. The Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange allows us to give you stories that are happening in Colorado but still matter to us on the Western Slope. Here's a more lighthearted piece that celebrates a popular aspect of rodeo culture. Mutton busting was first introduced back in the 1980s, but the crowd pleaser is now a favorite at many rodeos and county fairs across Colorado. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon followed one young mutton buster as she got ready for her very first ride at a rodeo in Colorado.
6-year-old Nevaeh Salgado stands quietly off to the side while her father, Dominic, signs a waiver. She's one of the many kindergartners clinging to their parents' legs. Most are dressed in cowboy hats, denim, and Western-style shirts. Nevaeh's wearing a pink plaid shirt, bedazzled with a sparkly galloping horse.
What are you coming to do?
I'm gonna ride the sheep.
Nevaeh saw other kids try mutton busting at last year's rodeo and insisted she try it this time. Participants are usually between the ages of 5 and 7, so at 6, Nevaeh is right in the sweet spot. Her mom, Daisha, says she can be a little spitfire.
She's very independent. She is. I mean, she's always, Mom, I can do it myself, and I can do this. And I mean, when it comes to animals, she loves animals, so this is something that's a good experience for her.
Last night we practiced before I went to bed. I fell off and then I got back on and I hanged on tight around his neck.
A chain link fence with thin plastic slats separate the sheep from the group of young mutton busters while they wait. Nevaeh presses her face against it to sneak a peek.
Can you tell which one you want?
The one that's standing up.
That's a big one.
Yeah, that's why I want a big one.
Looks pretty fluffy.
It does.
Just like the sheep, rodeo staff corral the kids into a small holding pen.
All right, there we go.
And fasten on black vests and helmets.
Does that fit okay? Feel okay for you?
This is kind of hard, but this is good.
Huh? The mutton busters get a few final stretches in.
All right, let's touch our toes.
Some last-minute pep talks.
And whatever happens, you do the best you can.
And it's off to the arena.
Listen to these people. You're crazy. Go out to watch some little kids ride some sheep.
The children stand in a line, waiting their turn to be lifted up by a couple cowboys and onto the back of a sheep. They stand wide-eyed, glancing up to their parents in the stands, looking nervous and excited. Everyone's ready with technique advice for the kids.
Are you ready?
75.
Okay. Know what to do? Okay, just grab on as hard as you can. Come off, you want to have fluff in your hands, okay?
Here comes Nevaeh.
Nevaeh clings to the sheep, arms around its neck, and when the cowboys let go, it darts forward in a straight line. Six seconds later, and Nevaeh slides off and gets a face full of dirt.
Holy mackerel! Jack Ryder!
The kids are judged on how long they held on and for style. Nevaeh's 88 points was a high score, enough to put her in second place. And after all the adrenaline in the arena, Nevaeh is reunited with her parents.
Angel, oh my goodness, I'm so proud of you.
Good job.
Can we see what you did?
Were you scared?
No.
Was it fun?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I ate. There was dirt in my mouth.
Was there dirt in your mouth?
A mouthful of dirt, a couple fistfuls of wool, and a shiny belt buckle are her prizes. And because she's only six, Nevaeh says she'll be back next year for another try at first place. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Peonia residents will decide if they want to allow retail marijuana facilities in their town during a special election in November. Laura Pomisano went to a town council meeting last month where the council debated even putting it to vote.
In 2010, Peonia voters chose to ban all commercial medical marijuana businesses from their community. During a special election in November, town residents will decide if they want retail marijuana facilities in Peonia. Tuesday night, the town board of trustees decided on the ballot language for the special election. The council was split on the decision, and Mayor Neil Schwederman broke the tie with a yes vote. Schwederman says the board has the power to ban retail marijuana facilities, but he's glad voters will decide instead.
The last election, the election where the medical marijuana retail establishments were banned from town, that lost by 16 votes, which is 0.94% of our electorate. And I don't know how to vote representing this community. I don't, because it's so close to 50%. I couldn't venture a guess. And I've always advocated for putting it on the ballot so the voters can decide.
The ballot will ask people if they want to allow the following four types of establishments: retail marijuana cultivation, product manufacturing, testing, and stores in Peonia. The ballot will be all or nothing. Either all four types will be allowed or banned. Trustee Charles Stewart says the ballot language comes right out of Colorado's voter-approved Amendment 64. Stewart calls the wording of the ballot question deceptive.
So people need to understand that if this passes, there is no legal prohibition for cultivation facilities within Peonia. There is no legal prohibition against production manufacturing facilities, and there is no prohibition against testing facilities. The only thing this board could do is regulate those businesses.
Stewart, along with trustees Susan Watson and David Bradford, voted against the ordinance calling for the special election. Amber Kleinman, Eric Gould, and Ross King voted for it. Here's King speaking at the meeting.
I have a mind that, yes, we will impose fees, licenses, taxes. I am not of a mind to condemn this industry to the gloom and doom that I keep hearing people suggesting that it's going to have. I see a lot of people in this room, and I know they use marijuana. I don't think they're not law-abiding citizens. I don't know the reason why everybody assumes this is going to be the worst thing that ever happened to our community. I don't get it.
The meetings are open to the public. Constantine Hirschfeld came to voice his opinion on the issue.
And I could not understand why, when we voted down the medical marijuana stores here, why we want to have retail stores here. I'm totally against it. I'm voting against it because I don't believe that marijuana should be legal in the first place. The second place is the marijuana users say that it's not addictive, but part of the taxes is going to go for rehab centers. And as far as I'm concerned, is my own opinion, if they need a rehab center, then they don't need the marijuana. Get rid of let them die, as far as I'm concerned.
Parts of the meeting also got heated.
And I do want to go on the record as saying this is definitely a first where we've heard the town board threatened. I hope we got that on the record.
It sounded
like one.
Well, I'm saying, as voters, we will use our voting power of the people to take care of our town.
Margot Richardson also gave her thoughts on the issue.
What I would like to see is us start small with just retail marijuana sales in town. We know that pot's already grown in the region, that we're well known for it, and that's not going to stop. It's a part of our economy. And I feel like it's more consistent and more honest to have legal retail sales in town.
The special election will be held on November 4th in conjunction with the general election. Registered voters will receive a mail ballot.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Local Motion. This week, we're showcasing the original feature reporting KVNF does across the region. Fracking is a contentious issue on the Western Slope. Jake Ryan went to a community meeting where two doctors gave presentations about the possible health risks of living near oil and gas wells.
The Grand Valley Citizens Alliance held a meeting in Parachute. It was a public discussion about the health effects of oil and gas drilling. There were two guest speakers, Dr. Lisa McKenzie and Dr. John Hughes.
I'm Lisa McKenzie. I'm a research associate at the Colorado School of Public Health, University of Colorado, Denver.
McKenzie worked on a health impact assessment for Garfield County back in 2010. It was never finished for the county due to budgeting, but McKenzie's group finished the study anyways and published it in peer-reviewed journals.
The health impact assessment basically found that the possible health impacts from the oil and gas project that was going to go into Battlement Mesa could possibly have impacts to health through hazardous air pollutants in the air, non-chemical stressors like noise and increased traffic, and then changes in the community and stresses in the community.
Her presentation was very straightforward. Her talk was peppered with cautions and guarded statements. Dr. Hughes was next.
I usually work in Basalt and Aspen, Colorado, and I do integrative medicine, which basically is helping people keep from using drugs and doing surgeries if possible.
After struggling to help some of his patients, Hughes started looking into how close they lived to gas wells and their levels of VOCs. Volatile organic compounds are chemicals like ethylbenzene, xylene, and others that are found in petroleum products.
We found a significant elevation in a particular type of volatile organic compound called ethylbenzene, as well as xylenes, which are, you know, emissions from natural gas wells.
But as Dr. Hughes himself pointed out before he began, he's not a scientific doctor. He's a medical doctor who did this research for his own knowledge. His study wasn't peer-reviewed or held up to rigorous standards. He also didn't exactly have the detachment of McKenzie either.
You guys have heard Fracking Looper, you know, I think he was put there by Encana, so it's not like anybody is, that's a secret to anybody.
David Ludlam is the executive director for the West Slope Colorado Oil and Gas Association. He was there and took issue with Dr. Hughes's presentation, contrasting McKenzie's academics with Hughes's activism. He said the industry is on the same side, investigating potential health hazards.
We're proud of the progress that we've made over the last decade as it relates to reducing emissions, improving water quality, and having a better understanding of the impacts that we do have and how to mitigate and improve them all the time.
He questions Hughes' results and called the accusations insulting.
I think you're trying to deliver a good industry, but it needs to be cleaned up, and you almost have to take it to the extreme and seeing how detrimental it could be in order to be motivated. If we just say, oh yeah, maybe it's dangerous, maybe it's not, we're all going to sit on the sidelines until something is really articulated in a perhaps motivating way.
For Hughes, the risk, just the possibility that gas wells might be causing health problems, is enough to take drastic action.
KVNF and our partners in Rocky Mountain Community Radio also participate in the Capital Coverage Project. Benta Berklin is the reporter based out of Denver who brings us coverage of political and governmental issues that can have immediate impact throughout the state. Recently, Governor John Hickenlooper and Democratic Congressman Jared Polis reached a deal to avoid an expensive fight at the ballot box over oil and gas drilling. Benta Berklin took a look at the next steps. She talked to State House reporters about what the deal means politically and the likelihood of a legislative compromise succeeding.
Joining us, we have Ivan Moreno, a reporter with the Associated Press, and Peter Marcus with the Durango Herald. Ivan, this deal had been talked about for months, you know, a way to avoid this huge ballot fight. I know Governor John Hickenlooper was in the middle of negotiations. Lawmakers failed to pass a bill during the session.
In some ways, this is as good as an outcome that Hickenlooper could have expected in an election year where you have this issue of fracking, a very divisive issue of fracking potentially being on the November ballot. And what ended up happening is with Hickenlooper getting both sides to agree to pool their dueling initiatives in exchange for this creation of a task force that will actually look at issues regarding local control, property conflicts between residents and energy companies, and this task force will issue recommendations next year to the legislature. So in essence, it's kind of like a stopgap measure, which for Democrats is a very good thing. You have Hickenlooper running for re-election. You have a very contested U.S. Senate race between incumbent Mark Udall and Cory Gardner. So this issue on the ballot was a huge distraction and a concern for Democrats who worried that maybe it would boost Republican turnout and have this huge amount of money from energy companies flooding in for Republicans.
And Peter, one of the key players is Democratic Congressman Jared Polis. He was sponsoring two of the anti-fracking measures. He did back down. Do you think because of this political unknown, and it is such a high-stakes election year for Democrats and Republicans, do you see that as an overriding factor?
I think the big question is, when did Jared Polis decide he was going to pull these ballot initiatives? I mean, there's the political dynamics of it, which you just talked about. Obviously, Democrats were pressuring him. Hickenlooper didn't want to deal with this. Udall didn't want to deal with this election season. But some have been speculating that Jared Polis was never really that serious about getting these on the ballot. There was $1.3 million canceled from their ad buy over a week ago. Some folks wondered whether Jared Polis was just kind of holding this over everyone's head so that he could force the issue and potentially get the legislature to address it. That's going to happen. There's a task force that will meet to recommend legislation. Whether the legislature actually acts is a whole nother story altogether. But, I mean, they're going to have to at least address it now.
Colorado is filled with history of these blue ribbon panels getting formed to address, I mean, whatever issue you could think of, and nothing really coming from it. Next year, we don't know what the makeup of the legislature is going to be. It won't be an election year, so maybe there won't be this urgency to actually get anything done. So, I mean, it remains to be seen what the results will end up being.
And also just from the policy perspective, a lot of communities along the Front Range that have banned fracking, they want much more stringent rules, where you have the oil and gas industry, the governor, and a lot of other folks, including some Democrats, say, hey, we have strict standards and nothing needs to be changed. So that's a big divide to try to breach.
Well, that was another huge win out of this that honestly is being lost. It's under the radar, is that Longmont just got a huge win out of this. I mean, the governor just agreed to drop their lawsuit against Longmont for enacting rules and regs that overstepped the state's authority. That was an angle for Jared Polis, too. These are communities that he represents. The Front Range communities, the five of them that have either banned or placed moratoriums on fracking, you know, there's a little less pressure on them now because of this deal. So, I mean, another, you know, success right there through this whole deal for both Jared Polis and I guess we'll see for Hickenlooper.
Thanks. That was Peter Marcus with the Durango Herald and Ivan Moreno with the Associated Press. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
A few weeks ago, Olathe hosted its annual Sweet Corn Festival. It was a sprawling event in the summer sun that had all-you-can-eat corn on the cob, live music, and of course, a sweet corn eating contest. Jake Ryan takes us there.
Olathe hosted its annual Sweet Corn Festival. It was a sprawling event in the summer sun, but under the large white tents in the corner, up on the hill, the local volleyball team was handing out all-you-could-eat Olathe sweet corn. Becky Patrone is the head coach for the team. Behind her, custom-made roasters churn out an endless stream of roasted corn.
I've spoken to a lot of people that come from Durango, from Parachute, from Junction, and they've waited all year for this, so it's pretty cool that they come all the way down to our town for this festival.
What makes this, why do they come? What makes this so great?
Everybody loves our corn. I mean, people from around the state drive for our corn, and so I think just they love the corn, they love the atmosphere, and who can't turn down free sweet corn, right?
Across the field was the main stage, where the Black Canyon Barbershop Chorus, completing the sense of Americana at the town fair, began to sing. After an appetizing corn dog eating contest, they started the main event of the day, the corn on the cob eating contest.
3, 2, 1, eat!
It's a 4-minute blitz of loud music, play-by-play announcements, and two tables of people feverishly eating corn on the cob as fast as they can.
3, 2, 1, done! Arms in the air, remember we practiced this. Let's count them up.
When all the cobs dropped, Becca Stout, her hands still shaking, was declared the victor for the third year in a row. Her secret strategy?
And I don't eat corn until this event.
You don't eat corn all year long until now?
Mm-mm. No, I'll drink a beer out in the parking lot, and then I'll come and I'll practice once with one ear, and then I'm good. Every year.
It seems to do the trick.
Exactly.
So what was the grand total? What did you win with?
11 ears in 4 minutes.
That's crazy.
I know. It's my favorite day of the year.
That's it for the local news roundup on Local Motion. To hear more original regional reporting, tune in weekdays at 8 a.m. and 5:50 p.m. right here on KVNF. Thanks for listening. I'm Patricia Naft.